us for our 2021 Annual Business Law Institute. It is important for us to uphold a Polsinelli tradition of providing an innovative CLE program to our clients, general counsel friends, and Polsinelli alumni. And given the circumstances, we are pleased to be able to do so again this year in a virtual setting. During today's webinar, you will be asked to answer two CLE polling questions. In order to receive your CLE certificate of attendance, you must answer the polling questions. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours after the webinar to all those who answered the polling questions. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewing of this program. Please use the Q&A box to submit questions to our speakers throughout the webinar. If they are unable to answer during the live program, our speakers will connect with you via email after the program. If you experience any technical difficulties, please type your question in the Q&A box and our engineer will assist you. To access the materials from today's webinar, please reference the Resources tab. Please visit www.bli.polsinelli.com for additional information, including CLE application statuses, a detailed view of this year's schedule, and more. We look forward to connecting with you throughout the summer and coming back together in person next year. I'd now like to pass it over to my colleague to kick off today's program.
Hello, all. Thanks for joining us remotely here today. We're pleased to be with you, and hopefully it's in person next year, as Ashley just mentioned. My name is Gordon Spring, and I'm a shareholder in the St. Louis office of Polsinelli and a member of our corporate and transactional practice group with a particular focus on mergers and acquisitions, including private equity M&A. I'm pleased to be joined by my colleagues for today's program, and with that, I'll turn it over to Bob.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. I'm Bob Spake. I'm a shareholder in our Kansas City office. I'm in litigation, and I mostly focus on the Delaware court systems, both the Court of Chancery and the Delaware Superior Court, and also class action defense. For example, the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, if you all are familiar with that. Relatedly, I did clerk for the Delaware Court of Chancery and have been doing a lot of that work for a long time. And I am a member of the firm's M&A litigation working group, which Noam chairs, and I'll pass it off to him.
Thanks, Gordon, and thanks, Bob. And good afternoon, everyone. My name is Noam Fishman. I'm a shareholder in Polsinelli's litigation department based in our D.C. office. I represent clients in a significant number of fraud and fiduciary duty matters, often in the deal space. I chair the firm's mergers and acquisitions litigation working group, and I'm editor of the Polsinelli Pulse, a newsletter focused on deal-related litigation issues. And now, if we transition to the next slide, we'll discuss the goals for today's presentation. Today, we're focusing on four topics. First, we're going to provide a brief overview of the duty of care and the duty of loyalty. We will discuss the meaning of those duties for corporate officers and directors of entities of all kind, irrespective of whether you're considering public companies, private companies, or nonprofit organizations. Next, we'll consider the standards of review, in other words, the business judgment rule, intermediate scrutiny, sometimes referred as the Revlon or Unocal standards, and the entire fairness test applied by Delaware courts to adjudicate the propriety of a corporate transaction. And we'll consider the implications of having a chancellor or vice chancellor in the Court of Chancery as both the judge and fact finder as compared to other jurisdictions, in which these cases could be decided by juries. We'll also consider how applicable law may change outside the state of Delaware, for instance, the impact in some jurisdictions that do not have the intermediate scrutiny test. And finally, we'll integrate all of these concepts in considering their impact on a hypothetical deal. With that, I'll turn the mic back over to Bob to discuss the duty of care and the duty of loyalty.
Yeah, thanks, Noam. So for those paying attention, this topic could be important later on in the conversation, maybe after Gordon discusses the hypothetical. But there are two standard fiduciary duties that people consider, that's the duty of care and the duty of loyalty. There is also a duty of good faith, but that's a historical triad thinking. The duty of good faith is now more or less a subset of the duty of loyalty. But boiling it all down, not worrying about all the case law, a question that people ask themselves at the boardroom is basically, would your mom be proud of you in making this decision? And I think if, not knowing your own mother, but if your mother would be proud of you of making the decisions, you're probably going to be good on both of these duties. The duty of care is a question of, is a director asleep at the switch, or are they reasonably involved in this decision-making process, and are they reasonably informing themselves about the decisions they're making? Directors are presumed to act on an informed basis, in good faith, and the honest belief that the action they're taking is in the best interest of the company. And courts aren't going to second guess those decisions under the standard. Typically, it's judged more on a rationality basis. And when you think about rationality, I had a law professor tell me it would be someone like flashing $100 bills down the toilet and saying, no, I think this is in the best interest of the company. It's a pretty high standard. Also, in considering the duty of care, it's important to keep in the back of your minds that Delaware, after a famous case, Smith v. Van Gorkum, passed 8 Del C 102b7. 102b7 is a term that may be familiar to many of you, but for those who it's not, there is almost every Delaware corporation has a 102b7 provision. It says that there is no monetary liability to a director for breaching the duty of care. That said, advisors may still be liable for breaches of the duty of care, but it's just something to be aware of. And that takes us to the duty of loyalty. The duty of loyalty, again, would your mother be proud of you for making this decision, is effectively asking, are you lining your own pockets at the expense of someone else, or are you giving yourself a benefit that others aren't equally getting? Now, that said, you don't have to sacrifice your own personal interests. For example, if you have a contractual right that allows you to a benefit that others don't have, you don't have to fall on your sword there, and that can get into the weeds. But again, the basic issue is, are the decisions you're making in the ultimate benefit of the stockholders in general? And the main question the court is going to ask is whether you're gaining some benefit, or are you at the fear of losing some benefit that doesn't affect all other stockholders equally. So that's the decision being made there. And to give you an example, we have a bullet point here for Bashu. This is a case ripped from the headlines, inspired by true events, that we were involved in, where a shareholder and founder and former CEO of one of the first cloud computing companies sued a later round investor in that company. And the reason is, the founder alleged that the later round investor wrongfully took control of the company and destroyed value of the business. This included moves like putting the company intentionally in a cash crisis because of other financial instruments he had to benefit him gaining control, and also placing friendly people in management such that he could then control the board and the officers. And through these maneuverings, he gained effective control of the company. And just as a footnote here, there's a difference between hard control and effective control. Hard control is owning 50% plus of voting rights, so you can basically just do anything you want. You can push it through. But still, you need to be aware of effective control or soft control. That's where you may own 30% of a company or even 25% of a company, but through other financial devices or otherwise, your ability to control the officers and directors, you can basically force through what you want. You need to be aware of the duty of loyalty in that type of situation. And to at least know that if you're doing something to enrich yourself, such as site consulting contracts, be cognizant of your fiduciary duties and beneficial shareholder rights. There just may be other liability that someone may challenge at some point. And now I will pass it off to Gordon to talk about another hypothetical.
Thanks, Bob. Yeah, so I think inspired by true events, your commentary there is fair for this hypo as well. I'd say, you know, a combination of true events. So these are real life examples that we've seen in practice and hopefully provide a basis for some learnings here. You know, certain parts of this are fairly typical and others less so. And also, please bear with us for a moment as we run through this, because as is typical with fiduciary duties analysis, this hypo is pretty fact intensive. So before we jump directly into the board, let's flag, you know, how these directors in this hypothetical situation came to be. So we essentially have three distinct groups of ownership. We have a private equity fund that's referenced on this slide as PE1, which owns a majority of the capital stock. We have a second private equity fund with a minority ownership interest. And then lastly, there's a management team, sort of aggregation of individual management team members that collectively hold the remaining minority ownership interests. So as is also typical, the board representation aligns with the ownership percentages, such that the first private equity fund, as the majority owner, had the right to appoint a majority of the board and effectively had the hard effective control that Bob was just referencing. Each of the second private equity fund and the management team members have minority representation on the board, so seat but not control. Related party agreements are pretty customary in corporate transactions, particularly M&A transactions, and negotiating those governance provisions is key. With private equity-backed companies, those sometimes take the form of management consulting agreements, so agreements that can have a few different names but share the theme of an affiliate of a private equity fund investor providing some consulting and advisory services, often fairly ordinary course in nature, in connection with the receipt of a fee. That's sometimes based on financial performance or other metrics. As a similar agreement, which can be part of it and combined with the management consulting or distinct in a separate agreement as we have in this hypo, a private equity fund may also, or an affiliate thereof, may also be paid a fee for transaction advisory services. So very similar to the management consulting, but more narrowly tailored to assistance with a particular transaction, whether debt financing, equity issuance, or change of control. Parameters on those related party agreements can be negotiated, as with any other governance provision. And in this case here, it's safe to assume that the minority private equity fund owner and possibly the management team negotiated some limitations in the transaction advisory agreement. With the key negotiation and resulting provision being that no fee compensation was owed pursuant to the transaction advisory agreement in the event that the majority owner or an affiliate thereof was the acquirer. So in connection with a sale to an affiliate of the majority owner, the first private equity fund does not get a fee. That turned out to be some savvy negotiation, which benefited both the second private equity fund and the management team in connection with the sale. The second fund was desirous of some liquidity. The first fund was nearing the end of its fund life, but still liked the investment. And a new fund vehicle of the private equity fund number one as the controlling investor, again, through a new fund vehicle, acquired all the capital stock held by both of those funds in a transaction pursuant to which the management team actually retained all their stock. So got no cash in connection with the deal, continued on in their ownership position, and as a result was pretty interested in the balance sheet of the company on a go-forward basis. That negotiation, the transaction advisory agreement, was helpful because based on the structure of this transaction, no fee would have been owing to the first private equity fund. So there's, you know, something here for everyone. No concerns about fiduciary duties, right? You know, PE Fund 1 was able to achieve the liquidity they wanted, for its current fund vehicle. The second PE fund was able to achieve liquidity that they needed. Management team got to continue in connection with, both employee roles and management team roles, as well as their ownership positions with a sponsor they, knew well. And the PE1 majority owner affiliate stepped into the shoes and continued. But like a good infomercial, just wait, there's more. So we have here in our last bullet a reference that there's a new restated transaction advisory agreement that comes into the picture. It's proposed to be executed immediately post-closing, and the draft that is circulated for review includes a fee that's due on the closing date for services provided in connection with the sale transaction. So post-closing agreement, pre-closing agreement said no fee, post-closing agreement says there's a fee. It's coming on the closing date. And so with that hypothetical starting, I'm going to turn it over quickly to Ashley for an important polling question.
Great. Thank you so much. This is the first CLE polling question for today's program. You must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. All board members owe both a duty of care and a duty of loyalty to shareholders. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your internet browser and try again. Again, all board members owe both a duty of care and a duty of loyalty to shareholders. Select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you are having issues submitting, please email events@pulsinelli.com. Again, that's events@pulsinelli.com. Going to give you guys another 45 seconds to answer. Please hit true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. And this is the first out of the two polling questions that will be asked today. I'll give you guys another 15 seconds. All right, great. Thank you, guys. I'll pass it back to Bob.
Thanks, Ashley. Yeah, so now we're going to get to the standards of review section. We have that slide up. Yes. So this is one of the more important takeaway slides, in my opinion, from the presentation. And this is when you're at the deal table, often people don't necessarily think about this, but if your transaction is going to be challenged, who's going to be making that decision and what standard of review are they going to be applying to your decision, and how can you do something at the deal table to help protect the deal and protect yourself? So as far as who's going to decide it, Noam's going to speak mostly about that, but it's a judge or a jury. That, you know, Delaware Court of Chancery, judges, a lot of states, you're going to have a jury. And then what I'm going to be speaking about now is what is the standard of review that will be applied. There is the business judgment rule, enhanced scrutiny, which most people colloquially, they'll talk about UNICAL and Revlon, and entire fairness. Not all jurisdictions have juries apply all of these standards of review. So that's another thing to think about in process. But if you are in a jurisdiction, for example, Delaware, where these standards of review are applied, the business judgment rule is the default standard of review. It's the review applied when you have an independent and disinterested board making a decision, and then a court is only going to look at the decision made for rationality. This is the friendliest standard of review. You basically have to be irrational. Now, it's possible to be irrational, but not often. So then the next standard of review is enhanced scrutiny. This is the intermediate standard of review. This is the reasonableness standard of review. So again, business judgment, rationality, enhanced scrutiny, reasonableness. And this is where you may have an independent and disinterested board, but given the structure of the transaction, there's a reason to want to take a closer look. For example, the board's trying to sell the company, or the board's reviewing a hostile takeover. So again, the directors may be independent and disinterested, but just because of the structure of the deal, courts are going to take a closer look and look for reasonableness. The third standard of review is entire fairness. This is the highest standard of review, and this is where you actually have a conflicted board. There is someone on both sides of the deal, someone is otherwise not independent, and that's where the court is going to want to look at the decision to decide if it's entirely fair. This can often be a battle of the experts, evaluation consideration, but again, they're going to look at both process of the deal and price. Price is going to mostly govern, but in this situation, courts will look at fairness. And at this point, I'll pass it off to Noam to talk about the process and who will be making these either rationality, reasonableness, or fairness decisions.
Thanks, Bob. And so my comments are going to be really focused on the lens and who's going to be making, whose lens is going to be used to review a claim. So unlike courts of general jurisdiction, that's courts that hear both legal and equitable claims, the Delaware Court of Chancery sits only in equity. The Court of Chancery hears cases involving land disputes, trust and estate matters, but for our purposes, they hear a disproportionately large number of corporate disputes as compared to other courts around the country. They're presided over by a chancellor and vice chancellors who hear and decide the legal disputes and importantly render the findings of fact. They do this alone without juries. And this distinction can be very meaningful. Unlike most courts in which judges hear a lot of different types of cases, criminal matters, civil cases, and all kinds of different kinds of civil cases, the chancellors and vice chancellors of the Delaware Court of Chancery are overwhelmingly hearing fiduciary duty and corporate governance cases applying the standards that Bob described, which brings us to the law and jurisdiction comparison in the next slide. Substantively, the choice of law provision and deal documents really, it matters. Some jurisdictions, like New York listed above in the slide, recognize an intermediate standard of review, which brings the case law in that jurisdiction closer to alignment with Delaware. But in other jurisdictions around the country, and we just have a few listed here, Missouri, California, Florida, there is no intermediate scrutiny. They do not apply Revlon or Unocal. So the business judgment rule or some variant of the entire fairness test are going to be the two possible standards that the court would apply. And the impact, although it might sound like some sort of litigation procedure minutia, it could really matter on the outcome of a case, and here's why. Bob just described situations in which the intermediate standards would apply. And then under those standards, although a board might be entitled to less deference, at the risk of oversimplifying, in most of those cases still, the plaintiff in a case would still hold the burden of proof of showing impropriety. This means that the plaintiff has to show wrongful conduct, ordinarily by a preponderance of the evidence standard. The burden of proof matters because it's the tiebreaker. It tilts the court in jump ball situations. But in outside of Delaware and New York and other jurisdictions that don't follow Delaware and New York, there's a far, far greater risk that cases would otherwise be reviewed, the cases that in Delaware would have been reviewed under Revlon or Unocal, would be reviewed under the entire fairness test. In turn, for those cases, there's an enhanced risk of shifting the burden of proof, meaning that the burden would be on the defendant to prove the fairness of the transaction rather on a plaintiff to prove the unfairness of a transaction. And keep in mind, fiduciary duties are intensely fact-specific cases, and litigators are skilled at spinning these facts. And they can, these cases, it can at times be very close calls. This pivot of the burden of proof under the entire fairness test can have a material impact on the likelihood of success in litigating a case. Again, it tilts the court and impacts who wins the close call jump ball scenario. Finally, the procedure impact of the venue and choice of law questions also matter immensely. Most jurisdictions, including the four listed on the slide, do not have a separate court sitting in equity like the Court of Chancery. Rather, in most cases, if a case proceeds to trial, that trial is going to be decided by a jury. And the reality is that jury brings to a case a greatly higher variability of outcomes. In these cases, strategy will heavily slant towards trying to obtain summary judgment, and if not, maximizing your potential position at mediation or settlement. To state it more succinctly, jury verdicts are often unpredictable, and depending on a company's risk tolerance, the likelihood of a jury trial will impact how you choose to litigate a case. Okay, so now that we've discussed the legal standards and various procedural ramifications, let's talk about how the hypothetical that Gordon introduced might actually shake out in practice.
Yeah, thank you very much. So, I mean, what I'm taking from the corporate M&A side is broad brush. It's a reasonable conclusion that the, you know, sophisticated Delaware courts without juries, you know, sophisticated triers of fact, previous, you know, experience in private practice and a number of cases will be less swayed by, you know, the appeal of a plaintiff's fiduciary duty argument than some other state courts and maybe juries who might be less familiar with the law at issue. You know, that could be, you know, the exact opposite result in other states with a different approach in evaluating those claims. So from the private equity one fund, you know, private equity fund number one's perspective as controlling majority stockholder and also as the acquirer and the recipient of a fee, you know, they probably are favoring, you know, subject to other facts, favoring Delaware law, all other things equal in this situation. That is, you know, consistent with what we see from a practical perspective that Delaware is almost uniformly the default for you know, entity formation and governing law choice for stockholders agreements and voting agreements. You know, from the management team's perspective, they might want to explore here how, you know, another state's law and procedures would be applied to those claims. And, you know, it would be somewhat typical to at least explore initially, you know, the company's headquarters and state of operations for that decision making. You know, we're cognizant of the fact that, you know, fiduciary duty analysis isn't necessarily the driving force on jurisdiction choice for a lot of M&A transactions, but it's something that we would suggest should be added to the menu of considerations. You know, I want to continue to emphasize Noam's point regarding the predictability of outcomes. So, you know, the goal is always to avoid the litigation with proactive measures up front, and the decision-making is part of the deal process to avoid the courtroom to begin with. So objectivity and predictability regarding the interpretation of those claims and the duties themselves will help to achieve that result and stay out of court. So even if you settled on the governing law, you know, you can still, you know, focus on jury trial waivers, other mitigation items within the documents themselves. That might, you know, help achieve that result and drive a little more predictability. So approaches with respect to dispute escalation might be another path as well. So mandatory negotiation, mediation provisions, arbitration provisions, again, trying to land at sophisticated parties as the decision makers. Assuming we're stepping in late and we already have a transaction, we already have a fiduciary duty claim, you know, what do we have happen now? So, you know, Bob and Noam might disagree from the litigation perspective. From the corporate perspective, you know, candidly, I don't see litigation on many of my deals. I should probably knock on wood as I say that from the M&A side. Yet the ramifications, again, are significant. So keep in mind that private equity funds are partnering with management teams in an investment, as is the case in our hypothetical here. So private equity fund number one wasn't an operator. As a result, was relying on keeping the management team invested for the future growth of the company. That's all the more important as they reinvest through their affiliate, through a new fund, and continue to own equity of the company. From the management team's perspective, you know, they've got a complicated dynamic. They're sitting in a boardroom where they're present both as executives of the company to advise on company performance, as well as in their capacity as a director and a representative of their minority stock ownership. So those dynamics, you know, sort of temper the expectations of the parties and the aggressiveness of the parties frequently in these situations. So we could speculate on some ultimate outcomes based on a number of other facts. But with that, I'm curious, Bob, what do you think the board can best do to position itself in situations such as this?
Yeah, let me jump in, and I'm going to try to move this pretty quickly because I think we're running out of time a little bit. But I think Gordon's right. You know, we talk about this a lot. Our corporate colleagues rarely see litigation. Sitting in the litigation side of the shop doing Delaware and class action work, I only see the litigation side. So it's kind of a, you know, like the surgeon, if you're going into surgery and there's only a 1% chance of something bad happening, if it happens to you, it's 100%, not 1%. So that's just why we bring this up. It's that's the side I see more often. And how best to protect yourself from having a bad outcome. Again, There are some jurisdictions that recognize prophylactic measures to help you, others that don't. Just again, streamlining quickly, there is a case, M&F Worldwide, that came out of the Delaware Court of Chancery that said even in an interested transaction, if you condition the deal at the very outset, has to be at the outset, on a special committee and a majority of the minority vote, then those safeguards are going to be enough to get you business judgment rule review where you otherwise would have had entire fairness review. So not only does it matter from the standard of reviews phase, but it also just matters as a practical standpoint. Is someone going to challenge the deal? Like if you, again, condition it on a special committee and a majority of the minority vote, you'll get business judgment rule review, which should reduce the cost, stress, and uncertainty of any sort of trial or even getting to trial in the first place. Maybe you'll be able to kick it out on a motion to dismiss, and then you won't need to go through all the expensive depositions and, you know, requests for admissions and interrogatories and all of that. New York has also recently adopted M&F Worldwide, but it's just important to know which jurisdictions allow you to condition even interested deals early on those two conditions, and you'll be able to protect yourself. And with that, I'll throw it to Noam for post-deal board decision-making.
Right, and we're running out of time, so I'll just make a final point. And that's from a post-deal perspective, even a pre-deal perspective, collectively, the optics matter. The optics of your deal matter, and so understanding who your constituencies are, the potential risk emanating from those constituencies, and the optics of your transaction. If litigation is a risk in a deal you're negotiating or a deal you've recently negotiated, then taking a look at the optics and taking a look at the constituencies will go a long way to showing you the path of how to minimize that risk. Thank you.
Thanks. With that, we'll turn it over to our colleagues on the corporate social responsibility side. Thanks.
Thank you, guys. Thank you for joining us as we start our second session of the day for Polsinelli's BLI Institute. Our topic today is corporate social responsibility. My name is Jonathan Blum, and I'm a shareholder in Polsinelli's nonprofit practice group. Our practice group is dedicated to an expertise in all things nonprofit, including charities, foundations, advocacy organizations, and trade associations. We also work with companies formulating relationships with nonprofits or establishing their own nonprofits. Now to my colleagues, Christina and Nick, to introduce themselves. Christina?
Thanks, Jonathan. Hi there. I'm Christina Cahill. I'm a member of our nonprofit organizations practice group and excited to be here with you guys today.
Hello, everybody. My name is Nicholas McKissick, and I'm also an associate in a Polsinelli's nonprofit practice group. And I will get us started today speaking about corporate social responsibility. Corporate social responsibility is a management concept where a company integrates social and environmental concerns in their business operations and interactions with stakeholders. It's a hot topic in today's world. You know, now more than ever, people are eager to have discussions on issues that are important to them. Whether it's diversity, equity, and inclusion, or climate change, consumers and employees want to know what companies are doing to tackle social and environmental issues. For example, a 2020 CSR report estimates that 64% of Americans say it's no longer acceptable for companies to stay silent on social justice issues. The report also estimates that more than half of Americans say that companies that do not talk about social justice issues are out of touch with reality and consumers. Therefore, as you guys might imagine, due to the increased attention being given to these issues, we are seeing more companies engage in CSR programming. However, when engaging in a CSR program, there are a few key things that a company should keep in mind. First, the ultimate thing to remember is, what's the main goal that the company is trying to accomplish or establish? Is the company trying to engage with the community? Is it trying to build its brand, engage with employees? No matter what, the goal should be well-defined and understood. It's also important for companies to understand that being authentic matters. companies need to engage with impactful organizations and programs that represent what the company stands for, and also, you know, tell the story of what the company is doing to address social and environmental issues in today's world. To ensure authenticity, a company may consider engaging with employees through brief surveys or employee outreach. This will allow the company to understand what employees are passionate about and what they're interested in. A company must also make sure that the CSR program is consistent with their purposes and values. This may involve a company focusing on social and environmental issues that are aligned with what the company does in its for-profit business. Christina will now give us a quick overview of a few different CSR strategy options.
Thanks, Nick. So there are many, many ways a company can approach a CSR program in light of its own unique culture and goals. And ultimately, along with Nick's important point about authenticity, the top decision makers at the company will need to buy in to whatever format is chosen in order to both model and encourage the type of engagement the company is aiming for. So today we'll be discussing three options, which of course are by no means the only ones. So these include partnering with established nonprofit organizations, which can take various forms that we'll discuss momentarily. Another option that's quite popular is to create a corporate foundation, which is a separate nonprofit organization funded and often controlled by the company itself. And lastly, as an alternative to a corporate foundation, a company can create a donor-advised fund account at an existing sponsor organization. There are distinct pros and cons to these different approaches, as well as some traps for the unwary that we'll dig into a bit further. So, Nick, why don't you kick us off with the first option?
Sure, of course. The first option involves a company partnering or collaborating with another company. As a result, this option doesn't involve the creation of a new or separate entity. A few opportunities to collaborate under this option may include, you know, fundraising or providing volunteering opportunities for a company's employees. Fundraising could potentially include donations from either the company or its employees, sponsoring programs, or even creating newer joint programming with an existing charitable company. And we've seen examples of this before. One example is, you know, Susan G. Komen has partnered with the Dallas Cowboys to raise breast cancer awareness among football fans by honoring local breast cancer survivors and also hosting annual breast cancer awareness games during the month of October. You know, we see all of the pink everywhere during all of the games, and it's for a great cause. It brings awareness to breast cancer during the month of October. The second option is volunteering opportunities for employees, and this could also possibly include sponsoring events for employees, or, you know, giving employees the opportunity to volunteer and give back to their own community. For example, the American Heart Association recently partnered with SUDAT, a leading global transportation and logistics company, to provide tools and programming to raise health awareness and promote heart healthy living among SUDAT's employees. A company could possibly favor, you know, this form of collaboration for several reasons. First, a company can choose its level of involvement. For example, a company can choose the amount of the donation, the size of a scholarship, or the company's overall level of involvement in the program. Secondly, a company could also possibly enjoy lower administrative costs by collaborating with an established partner. This collaboration under this option allows a company to leverage a partner's core strengths to achieve each party's desired objectives. That way, if a company wants to engage with a strong partner, they can be able to participate to the level that they like. And lastly, obviously, this type of collaboration and partnership also may provide a boost in branding. A company could possibly be viewed as taking an active role in addressing social and environmental issues when it engages in this type of partnership or collaboration. With that said, you know, while there are benefits such as flexibility, you know, and involvement and limited administrative burden, you know, there is one downside. And the downside to this option is that, you know, a company may have a bit of a limited menu in terms of what they can deal with. For example, if a company decides to engage with an existing nonprofit company, the company or the nonprofit company that exists will have limits to what they're willing to do. Therefore, a company's opportunity to participate and collaborate with an existing nonprofit, you know, is going to depend on that nonprofit's level of sophistication. So therefore, you know, in some situations, a company that wishes or chooses to collaborate under this option, they may be handcuffed or limited in terms of what they may do. Jonathan will now explain another form of collaboration that's also common under this option.
Thanks, Nick. Next, we're going to talk about another example of collaboration with a nonprofit that's called Cause Marketing, also called Commercial Co-Ventures, or otherwise known as CCV. CCV occurs where a for-profit company holds a promotion where for each product or service sold, a fixed amount is donated to a charity. This kind of relationship is seen as a win-win-win, in the sense of the nonprofit receives funding, the company enjoys the halo effect of association with that nonprofit, and the consumer is able to participate in the donation, activating its own consumer base. Commercial co-venture has continued to trend upward as a number of studies have demonstrated that consumers tend to choose companies that align themselves with charities. So here are a few examples. Susan G. Komen Breast Cancer Foundation and Budget Car Rental have a CCV program where Budget is donating 5% of the base rate from certain reservations made online to Susan G. Komen until December 31st, 2021. Similarly, Barefoot Wines supports New Ventures Foundation through the sale of certain wines with a fixed amount of the purchase price of each bottle of wine being donated to the foundation. Commercial co-venture relationships are subject to state regulatory requirements in about 25 states. These regulations govern two aspects of CCV, consumer protection and the for-profit's relationship with the charity. The consumer protection aspect is to ensure clarity to the consumer, meaning that consumers are treated fairly through appropriate disclosures and actual donations. If the consumer's actions trigger a donation to the charity, then the consumer needs to be able to determine how much of a donation is triggered by the purchase, and they should be able to do that at the point of solicitation prior to the actual purchase. So, for example, a typical consumer disclosure would include the dates of the program, a minimum or maximum of any contributions permissible under the program, and the dollar amount or percentage of purchase price of the donation triggered by the purchase. These disclosures must be accurate and conspicuous, and the consumer must be able to decipher the donation amount at the point of solicitation. Generic terms like a portion of the proceeds are insufficient for those purposes. So a consumer would see, for example, for each purchase of a widget from June 1st to June 30th, $1 will be donated to this charity up to a maximum of $50,000. Both the charity and the for-profit need to be registered in the states required. The charity is required to register to solicit contributions, and the for-profit is registered as a commercial co-venture. Both sides have regulatory obligations. There are specific regulatory requirements for commercial co-venture programs beyond the consumer disclosure. Certain states require that the contract contain certain statutory provisions, and several states require the contract to be filed. A few of the states require the for-profit company to post a bond. There are also requirements regarding record retention and annual requirements for activity reporting. Commercial co-venture is definitely a trap for the unwary, but compliance is not difficult, and once understood, can be an effective means for generating goodwill for a company, a financial benefit to a charity, and a sense of contribution by the consumer. Christina will now discuss another option, corporate foundations.
Thanks, Jonathan. So corporate foundations are extremely popular components to many CSR programs because they are, in effect, a captive charity, allowing the company to have complete control and customization over the programming and the branding. There are trade-offs, of course, for that level of autonomy. And for the foundation, they include the fact that it must abide by various rules and restrictions, and the administrative requirements can be somewhat burdensome. So, for example, since it is a separate legal entity, the foundation must maintain corporate formalities and make annual filings to the IRS, not to mention that there must be people running the foundation's programs, grant making, and compliance. Additionally, most corporate foundations are private foundations, which are a type of nonprofit organization that is subject to additional rules applicable to its holdings, investments, charitable activities, and more under the federal tax code. The area that typically requires the most careful planning involves the rules against self-dealing, which prohibit certain types of transactions and relationships between the corporate foundation and individuals or organizations with certain enumerated close relationships to the foundation. What this often means in the corporate foundation context is that leaders must be cognizant about interactions with the for-profit parent, including using charitable funds in a way that may financially benefit the company itself. All that said, while a corporate foundation requires additional administrative effort, they are somewhat unique in offering the most flexibility for CSR program plugins and employee engagement. Since they are custom captive charities, they can be built to suit and allow for somewhat seamless integration with the company. And again, you know, these different options we're going over today are by no means the only ones, and they don't exist in vacuum. You know, companies can feel free to sort of pick and choose. So, for example, companies often engage in cause marketing with their own foundations, which, as Jonathan described, there are a number of different administrative elements. But by engaging in it with their own foundations, it can minimize the burden and provide that positive PR halo for multiple programs under the company's umbrella. Some companies create donation matching programs with their employees that give to the foundation, for example. And even more might actually create charitable programs that they operate through their foundations. So one example that you see up here on the slide is the Kaplan Educational Foundation, which is the foundation of the National Test Prep Company, actually created an employee volunteer program that's focused on mentoring and tutoring students that are hoping to transition from two-year college programs to four-year programs. And that employee program is a great example of the ability to tailor corporate foundation activities to directly align with the company values and even employee interest. Toyota USA Foundation is another example, and they generally work to support STEM education, but they also have a large grant-making program focused on workforce readiness and inclusive mobility, along with financial inclusion and community resilience. As you can see, you know, these companies were able to take, you know, key issues of their constituencies, both employees, consumers, you know, things that are happening in the world at large, and using their captive charity, they can really tailor their response to these issues. So when considering, you know, your unique company culture and CSR program goals, a corporate foundation is an excellent way to maintain control and customization with opportunity for a high level of employee engagement, though it does come with some relatively high administrative costs compared to some of the other options. I'm going to pass it to Ashley quickly for the true or false question.
Great. Thank you, Christina. This is your final CLE polling question for today's program. Again, you must answer to receive CLE credit. You should see the question in the slides box. Commercial co-venture regulations only apply to the charity, not the company that donates to the charity through a product promotion. Please select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If for some reason you are not seeing the polling question on your screen, please refresh your internet browser and try again. Again, commercial co-venture regulations only apply to the charity, not the company that donates to the charity through a product promotion. Select true or false and hit the submit button located in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. If you continue to have any issues hitting submit on the polling question, please email events@pulsinelli.com. I'm going to give you guys another minute. Again, this is your final CLE polling question for today's program. You'll select true or false and hit submit in the lower right-hand corner of the slides box. any issues, email events@polsinelli.com. Give you guys another 20 seconds. All right, guys, thank you. I'll pass it to Nick.
Yes. So the final option that we'll talk about today is the Donor Advised Fund, also called the DAF. The DAF is a charitable giving account that is maintained by a separate public charity called a sponsoring organization. An example of a sponsoring organization is the Silicon Valley Community Foundation. A characteristic of the Donor Advised Fund is that a company can make donations and recommend where the sponsoring organization makes grants over time. But the company does not have to deal with running, managing, or staffing the Donor Advised Fund. A Donor Advised Fund can be used as a quasi-corporate foundation. A company can use a Donor Advised Fund to engage in grant making to a variety of causes or organizations without the same administrative burdens that are found in a corporate foundation. Therefore, a company can create a separate charitable giving vehicle, but outsource the administrative and legal obligations. A company may choose this option as an alternative for several reasons. The first reason is simplicity. A company may be able to simplify its charitable giving through a DAF because the Donor Advised Fund is managed by another sponsoring organization. A company can suggest grants for a number of causes through a single fund, and it's the sponsoring organization's responsibility to ensure that the prospective grantee is legitimate and the grant gets out the door. A company may also prefer a Donor Advised Fund because it is not subject to the same restrictive rules as private foundations. DAFs are not subject to the same restrictions that apply to private foundations, but can be limited by law. For example, DAFs are prohibited from making grants that create a substantial benefit to a donor, donor advisor, or any other related party. Another reason a DAF may be favorable is if a company wants to engage in responsible and flexible grant making. The DAF allows a company to enjoy the ability to give to several causes and address changing social issues. For example, if a company wants to address breast cancer, a company can recommend a grant to an organization that addresses those issues through a donor advised fund without the hassle of a big administrative push. Or if there's a natural disaster, a company can donate to the Red Cross without the same big administrative push. Therefore, the company can enjoy a level of responsiveness and flexibility that it may not be able to enjoy in other options. While there are several benefits to the Donor Advised Fund, a Donor Advised Fund is subject to certain limitations. As I just mentioned, you know, it's subject and limited by law. Therefore, they're prohibited from making, you know, certain grants. And then secondly, a company could also face possible limitations on its recommended grant-making activities depending on the community foundation or the public charity that it's dealing with. In a DAF, a company can recommend, but it ultimately does not have formal control over grants or investments from a donor-advised fund. Therefore, they are limited to what the sponsoring organization will do. A sponsoring organization will usually dictate how the fund is operated unless the company has substantial bargaining power or a large account with the donor advised fund. Therefore, while a company may enjoy a level of simplicity using this option, it may not enjoy the same level of control and customization as a corporate foundation. There are also, you know, practical considerations to consider. For example, there may be challenges with a DAF for employee engagement if that's a goal of the company. Because the sponsoring organization operates and manages a fund, a company does not have the ability to fully engage or create programs that are directed towards their employees. Therefore, a company does not enjoy the same level of hands-on control in order to provide participation to employees. It's also unlikely that a company will engage in an actual CSR program if they engage in a donor advised fund. And this is because the company could possibly use the donor advised fund itself, the donor advised fund itself, to act as the company's charitable giving program. In conclusion for today, we've discussed three different strategy options. First, we discussed partnering and collaborating with other companies, either through cause marketing campaigns or sponsorship programs. And, you know, this option is maybe preferable because it allows people to enjoy a flexibility and participation and limited administrative burdens. However, a company may be limited based on what existing partners are willing to do. Secondly, Christina also discussed creating your own corporate foundation. This option allows a company to enjoy more customization and control. However, a company should be prepared to manage and staff the corporate foundation itself. Lastly, we discussed the donor advised fund, and this option also allows a company to create a quasi corporate foundation with limited administrative burdens, but a company will not enjoy the same level of customization and control as a corporate foundation. And it also will not enjoy the same opportunities to engage with employees. While we've discussed several options, it's important to note that this is not an exhaustive list of all the strategies that are available to a company. And we also want to highlight that these CSR strategies can be used in coordination with each other, as Christina mentioned earlier. However, with that said, the key thing to remember is that no matter what strategy is chosen and how it is used, the strategy should be authentic and tie back to the company's mission and overall objectives. It's important to make sure that these things feel real and the CSR strategies that are engaged in are authentic and feel real to the employees and public. With that said, we appreciate your time for today, and thank you so much.
Great. Well, thank you all. This concludes today's webinar. CLE certificates will be emailed within 48 hours directly to all who answered the polling question. Recorded version of the presentation will be available on the BLI website within 48 hours. CLE credit will not be available for on-demand viewings of this program. Thank you all for your participation.